We're back, and thank you for joining today's Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. It looks as if you missed us these last couple of weeks because we have a really nice large audience today, or maybe that's because our guest today is Ilya Shapiro, who, despite the efforts of Georgetown University, was not canceled and is very much out there telling us what we need to know about the Supreme Court. First, a quick introduction to the JPC. We are a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis on foreign and domestic subjects by leading scholars, academicians, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security relations, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. Ilya's going to be talking about that one. You can sign up for our articles and see our magazine In Focus Quarterly by going to our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. And if you've missed some of our webinars, go to the website as well, because everything is up there. You can see who you missed and you can watch them, and they are great. They're great because of the speakers, not because of me, but go there and look for them. In this series of calls, we have covered a lot of ground. We have gone from the pandemic and malign Chinese behavior, both internally and on Taiwan, wars in Syria, Yemen, Ukraine, and Azerbaijan, the Abraham Accords, school choice, the price of oil. Today, we have the Supreme Court, a subject that seems to have undergone a tremendous transformation in importance to the American people. Our guest is Ilya Shapiro. He is a fellow of the Jewish Policy Center, which makes me very happy to say. He's also a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. Previously, he was executive director and senior lecturer at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution. And before that, he was a vice president of the Cato Institute, director of Cato's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies, and publisher of Cato's Supreme Court Review. He's also the author of a book called Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court. And I want to say something here. Supreme Disorder was published in 2020, but the paperback version is out. And if you did not buy the hard copy, please, oh, love it, love it. If you didn't buy the hard copy, you really need to buy the paperback, because it is an amazing book. I reviewed it for In Focus Quarterly, and I want to provide my personal caveat from the book review. There will be a temptation to skip the history and read the chapters, What Have We Learned, Term Limits, More Radical Reforms, Question of Legitimacy, and the Conclusion first. There will be a temptation to delve into the fundamental questions. What is the Supreme Court for? Do we need one? If we do, can it be disconnected from our current political atmosphere? Should it be disconnected? Maybe the world really is a different place and the court, the job of the old court is no longer relevant. Those are the questions I asked in 2020, and I would say they are still relevant. And then I advocated that you read the history first. Let's see how we got here. I am going to ask Ilya about the book. He has also contributed to a wide variety of popular and academic and professional publications, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, every place you think he ought to be, he has been, and I hope he gets there again. He also regularly provides commentary for media outlets, and he once appeared on the Colbert Report. I'm going to ask him about the Colbert Report, too. A reminder for you as we get started, Q&A function on your Zoom. We are monitoring the Q&A as we go. We have some questions in hand already, but if you come up with a question, please write it down and we will see it. And for now, Ilya Shapiro, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Shoshana. It's as my career has endured some interesting turbulence in the last 6 months or so, I'm glad to still be a stalwart with the JPC and enjoy your programming both written and in this presentation form. And I just noticed behind you, you have one of those Russian nesting dolls with Soviet and Russian political leaders. I got one of those too from one of my trips to Russia. So there we go. I'm happy in Q&A. I'm not going to go into my whole Georgetown travails and whatnot. I'm happy in Q&A to answer questions about that and cancel culture and all that. Certainly wasn't looking in my career transition, having spent nearly 15 years at Cato, to become a poster boy for cancel culture, but you know, man plans and God laughs, and here we are. And so now I have an opportunity to shine a light on the rot in academia, but also to continue my commentary and analysis on the Supreme Court. And that's what my focus is on today. So this term that just ended a few weeks ago, the much advertised, expected, feared, longed for conservative Supreme Court majority coalesced. There were many false starts over decades, misfires, disappointments, going back to Richard Nixon's pledge in the 1968 campaign to reverse the Warren Court's activism. I actually point to 1968 as an inflection in how politics plays a role in the role of judicial philosophy becoming paramount. Or even before that, Eisenhower's disappointment in his appointees, Earl Warren and Bill Brennan. Conservatives will remember this term as the one when they finally had enough votes to overcome so-called defections. This is 5 years after Neil Gorsuch was confirmed the second term with Amy Coney Barrett. And the statistics bear this out. It's not just kind of the top half dozen cases or kind of a feel we get from what we read in the media. The term had 60 opinions and argued cases. That's actually low. But of those 60, 14 involved a 6-3 so-called partisan split. And to those, we can add 10 5-4 decisions, in all of which the three liberal justices stuck together. So we can consider 40% of the term, 40% of the cases, to be ideological, including, of course, the big ones on school choice, religion, guns, vaccine mandates, environmental regulation, and, of course, abortion. Conversely, only 15 cases, about a quarter of the total, were unanimous. These are striking numbers. The former, the ideological total, was quite high. The latter was quite low. Normally, about half of the cases are actually unanimous. And this is very different from any year since I became a court watcher. I've sort of been doing this for 15 years or so. And when you look at the 5-4 cases, I mean, setting aside the 6-3 ones that are purely Republican appointees versus Democratic appointees, when you look at the 5-4 cases, it wasn't a simple story about the cagey chief justice. You know, this is sometimes what we hear. He is now the swing vote, or, you know, now he's the sixth man, but so he defects even more. Not really. In all three 5-4 splits that resulted in a conservative win, 3 of the 10, it was Gorsuch who joined the liberals. And in the 7 liberal results, every conservative except Samuel Alito moved over, with Roberts and Kavanaugh doing so 4 times. So what all of that numerology shows is that having a margin of error matters. There's just a lot of fluidity showcasing the differing approaches to originalism, interpreting provisions for what they meant publicly when they were enacted, and other text, history, and structure-focused interpretive methods on the right. It's intellectually fascinating, but in practice, it comes together to make for stability in the law, and it's a return to common sense constitutionalism. Now, these developments also mean that to a large extent, this is much less the Roberts Court than it has been since Justice Anthony Kennedy retired. But even as Kavanaugh is still the median justice, he and Roberts were both in the majority 95% of the time. That's very, very high, of course. But we can't call it the Kavanaugh Court, I don't think. Indeed, if anything, this was the breakout term for Clarence Thomas, the senior associate justice. He wrote the majority opinion in the Second Amendment case, which I think is the most significant majority opinion that he's written in 30 years on the high court. And he got to assign the Dobbs opinion, the abortion case, to Justice Alito because Roberts was not in full agreement. This is all the more remarkable when you realize that none of this would have happened without about a dozen historical twists that all had to follow the right way to get us to where we are now. So first, nearly a decade ago, Harry Reid, when he was the Senate Majority Leader for the Democrats, eliminated the filibuster for lower court judges, which Mitch McConnell, who was then the Minority Leader, said that Democrats would regret. Justice Ginsburg declined to retire under President Obama. She said, well, they can't get anyone better than me, so I'll just hold out. Justice Scalia then died in February 2016, creating a rare election year vacancy. And I think without that happening, Trump would not have won. I mean, there are many but for causes for Trump winning. But without Scalia dying and then this other item of McConnell, now majority leader, pledging no hearings, no votes on a successor to Scalia, and his caucus held firm. I mean, I wouldn't put much money on Republican senators maintaining steel in their spines, but they held firm on this politically risky maneuver. And that allowed Trump, after his unlikely win as getting the nomination because of such a large field, and he only had to get a plurality to win the nomination. And then having that open seat held Republicans together and turned out cultural conservatives and populists, providing Trump the winning margin, the narrow winning margin in several key states, allowing him to win that election. And then Trump empowered his White House counsel, Don McGahn, and his team to pick judges who were originalists and textualists and have spines. You know, I like to joke that if only the Federalist Society were running the rest of the government, the Trump administration might have accomplished even more than it did. And then, again, the takeover of the Senate, now led by Chuck Schumer, filibustered Gorsuch, leading to, well, not yet in the majority. Eventually, the Democrats would take the majority. But when they were in the minority, they filibustered Gorsuch, leading to McConnell's thermonuking, I guess you could say, of the filibuster, getting rid of it for Supreme Court nominations, meaning every justice since has been confirmed with fewer than 60 votes. The Trump White House then stood with Kavanaugh when Democrats launched their 11th hour sex assault allegations. But that smear of now Justice Kavanaugh triggered GOP Senate gains in 2018. And so when Justice Ginsburg died on the eve of the 2020 election, Republicans were able to push through the Barrett nomination. All of these were unlikely events, but on such hinges does history swing. So, you know, let's dive more into the specifics of what the Supreme Court has been deciding. Now, if you get your legal news from social media with occasional links to reporting by actual media, you'd think that the court has made an extreme right turn. On this reading, rulings on cases involving school funding, prayer at schools, guns, environmental regulation, and of course, abortion, represent an ideological hijacking of the Constitution. And even more, since the six justices in the majority in each of those high-profile cases were appointed by Republican presidents, then those radical decisions were all partisanship disguised as law. Now, that's a take that you see not just, unfortunately, in Twitter trolls or Facebook lawyers, but highly regarded law professors and journalists. It's in all the top print and broadcast media, and I think it's disingenuous at best, or to use the technical legal term, it's hogwash. Now, I don't mean that reasonable people, legally trained or otherwise, can't disagree on the cases, or that anyone that contradicts my view is stupid or politically motivated. To the contrary, I think it's those attacking the court's legitimacy and calling the justices partisan hacks who seem to believe that the only way to reach the results we've seen is to act in bad faith for political reasons. That sort of attitude is not healthy, particularly at a time when institutional trust is already low and political tribalism increasingly prevents either side from accepting electoral outcomes. Now, you know, I don't have any magic fixes for our national discord. But there's a way to understand what's going on at the court as a very deep and serious legal dispute that nevertheless easily fits within the parameters of the rule of law. All you have to do is take at face value the originalism and textualism and related jurisprudence that the court's majority applies. Now, it's perfectly fine to disagree with that methodology or its application, but there's no more evidence that John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett are results-oriented than that Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, or Elena Kagan are. Now, to be sure, some on the right accuse the latter three of acting on their policy preferences, but there's no reason to question their good faith either. They simply have a different way of looking at the law, especially in the politically sensitive cases with ideological salience. Perhaps many of the court's critics who align with the liberal justices think that all jurists are results-oriented and vote their values, which is illegitimate when going in a conservative direction somehow. Now, I'm not versed enough in psychology to know if that kind of projection is at play, but it's really no way to run a popsicle stand. And in no honest, sane world are the legal rules announced in the big controversial cases radical. So, for example, states don't have to allow parents to use school funding on the educational program of their choice, but if they do, they can't discriminate against religious schools. Case called Carson versus Macon. Again, you can disagree. It doesn't sound radical. The right to keep and bear arms includes the right to bear arms without having to jump through arbitrary and effectively impossible hoops, the Bruin case. Now, you might not like the Second Amendment, but that interpretation of it does not seem radical. Courts aren't well positioned to decide when life begins or when rights attach, the Dobbs abortion case. Now, you know, people can, of good faith, can disagree on where exactly to regulate abortion. But as a lawyer or as a judge, the idea that a lawyer or judge doesn't have those kinds of tools should not be radical, you know, outside the context of our politics for the last decades. Personal prayer at public school events doesn't constitute the state establishment of religion. Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. Personal prayer, right? As long as you're not discriminating against people or installing a state religion. Again, can disagree with the analysis, doesn't seem radical. And for an administrative agency to assume great regulatory power, Congress must have given it that power clearly and explicitly, West Virginia versus EPA, which, by the way, I think is the most significant case in terms of long-term impact on our governance. People and lawyers can debate all of these points in good faith, but I don't think they're extreme. And the policy consequences may or may not be significant, but that's not the constitutional question. And with abortion, the issue that's, of course, gotten the most attention, it's healthier for us to fight democratically. That's what most countries have done. And Europe generally settled at restrictions after 10 or 14 weeks, which is more conservative than the Mississippi law that the Supreme Court upheld. And what would have happened in the United States had Roe v. Wade not short-circuited that process nearly half a century ago, as Justice Ginsburg said, among others. As the Wall Street Journal put it, quote, "The fury of the left's reaction isn't merely about guns and abortion. It reflects their grief at having lost the court as the vehicle for achieving policy goals they can't get through legislatures." That's a very understandable impulse, but I don't think it's one that fairly impugns the highest court in the land. So with that, I'll stop, and I look forward to all of your questions.
Okay, thank you. I feel smarter somehow. We have some questions, and again, let me remind you, listeners, if you have a question, Q&A function on your Zoom screen. So it's an election year, and a listener has asked us about the implications of Moore versus Harper. And I know you're going to explain clearly and succinctly what that means, but the question is, can state judges overrule legislatures in electoral policy? How much leeway do the courts have to change things that a legislature has enacted?
Right. So Moore versus Harper is a case that the court takes up next term about the regulation of elections. And it involves what's called the election clause of the Constitution that says that the manner of holding elections for senators and representatives is prescribed by the legislature of the states, by the legislature thereof, meaning the states. So the question is, when state courts, not federal courts, when state courts change or rewrite or interpret state legislation regarding elections in such a way as to, you know, radically change them, is there a federal remedy for that? Does that violate, you know, the election clause, which is known as the independent state legislature doctrine? Does it violate other kinds of voting rights protected by the federal constitution? And it's a very good question because it comes up again and again. Supreme Court declined to take up this issue coming out of Pennsylvania. In the 2020 election, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court famously rewrote certain rules about which ballots count and when they have to be dated and when they have to be received. Now, the number of ballots that ultimately were affected by that change was smaller than the margin by which Biden beat Trump in that state. But it could have been a very significant issue. And I was disappointed when after the election, the Supreme Court didn't take up the case because it's an issue, as I said, that comes up again and again, will no doubt come up again after the next elections. But it's good that they're taking it up now. The answer in this particular case, Moore versus Harper, is out of North Carolina, but it comes up in different states. And it's unclear how the court will act, because, for example, with regard to partisan gerrymandering, the court majority finally held that there is no administrable standard for determining when politicians take politics too much into account when drawing district lines. On this issue, maybe they will come up with something, like when the state court does is completely rewriting the law rather than interpreting it. I don't know if that can be written in a certain way, but this this case of the high profile ones next term is probably the hardest to predict. And by the way, it doesn't necessarily benefit one party or another. You have state courts controlled by Republican appointees, by Democratic appointees, legislatures controlled, by, vice versa. But it would certainly, to settle this issue, would, I think, be healthy for people's confidence in the integrity of elections.
I'm not sure we'll ever get back to where people have a lot of confidence in the integrity of elections, but I do hope that the courts could help that process. Here's another question. You mentioned the EPA case and said it was actually, in your view, a very important case because it suggests that Congress has to do its job and that part of the reason things come to the Supreme Court is because Congress has not actually created legislation. It's created kind of rules and allowed, government agencies to follow those rules or make their own rules or figure out how to implement them. Is it possible that, merging two things, that Congress has the power to allow abortions, for example, in certain circumstances, overriding what states want? The president's talked about health exemptions and sorts of things that he'd like to see codified into federal law. But it seems to me that if you're asking Congress to go legislate things, this might be something that they would legislate.
So these are, I think, at least two separate questions. The power of the executive branch or administrative agencies. First of all, has Congress given it that power? The issue the court decided in the EPA case was that when there are so-called major questions of economic or societal import, then Congress needs to speak clearly. We don't just defer to whether it's the EPA or the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Labor Department, any of these executive branch agencies. We don't defer to it just taking significant power unto itself. Congress must have clearly spoken to give it that. That's what's known as the major questions doctrine that the court went into in some detail. Another question is whether Congress properly can delegate certain kind of power, which is called the non-delegation doctrine. The idea that under separation of powers principles, the legislative branch, Congress can't give away that legislative power, whether it be to the executive branch, whether it be to a blue ribbon commission, whether it be to a czar or anyone else. And the courts avoided ruling in that way for many decades. And so other doctrines like major questions have arisen to deal with those kinds of issues. And the third issue that you raised with health exemptions or national abortion regulations or many other things is whether the federal government itself, whether Congress itself has power to legislate in those areas. And Congress's power is limited to the 17 powers enumerated in Article 1, Section 8, raising armies, coining money, importantly, regulating interstate commerce. So the question, and that's the one that's most often used, the one that's most often in contention, Obamacare's individual mandate, you'll recall, is that a regulation of interstate commerce? Ultimately, John Roberts found authority under the taxing power and that the tax on not buying insurance was justified there rather than a regulation of non-existing activity or interstate commerce. But here the question is regulating abortion or healthcare in other ways, is that a regulation of interstate commerce? And the answer is probably not. A number of justices have questioned federal power of that kind. The leading case in this context, United States versus Lopez from about 20 years ago, the Gun-Free School Zones Act was initially invalidated because possessing a gun near a school is not engaging in interstate commerce. Eventually, Congress amended the law to say that guns that had traveled in interstate commerce, to add that kind of jurisdictional hook. So Congress could pass legislation regarding the reinforcing, rather, not creating, but reinforcing the right to travel interstate, whether for abortion, to get an abortion or otherwise. But that right, as Justice Kavanaugh said in his concurrence in Dobbs, isn't in doubt anyway. In terms of nullifying state abortion prohibitions, whether criminal or civil, I don't see where Congress would have the power to do that. I think that would be invalidated by the Supreme Court. Conversely, I think a similar thing would happen if, you know, some Republicans have proposed fetal personhood bills, that is, disallowing, trumping state laws that allow abortion, either entirely or past a certain point. And so those kinds of bills that similarly would not relate to interstate commerce, as Justice Thomas talked about in the partial birth abortion case, invalidating the federal law on partial birth abortion a number of years ago. But the real battle would be over Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, which the 14th Amendment protects civil rights, substantive due process, equal protection, privileges or immunities. And Section 5 gives Congress power to legislate to reinforce those kinds of civil rights. Now, would granting fetal personhood and rights therein be a valid use of that power? Everything that we've seen from the existing justices says that they're simply not anywhere close to five votes for that position. But that's where that particular type of legislation would be litigated.
Okay. Here's a basic question from a listener. Can you explain the difference between a textualist interpretation of the Constitution and an originalist view?
Sure. Yeah. The textualism is essentially originalism for statutes or vice versa. So most statutes that the court takes up are fairly new statutes. You know, the oldest ones are like the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act, which, you know, date to the 70s. And so we're much closer to that time. You don't need to do so much historical research. We even have, you know, digital research that we can look at newspapers and dictionaries of that time to understand the meaning of navigable water, say, or, you know, certain terms in statutes. You know, occasionally they have to reach back and go to older statutes, in which case the exercise is similar to originalism, where if you're looking at the original Constitution or the Bill of Rights from the late 18th century, that's where you look at old dictionaries or the Federalist Papers, because they help explicate what a reasonable search means, or what a cruel and unusual punishment means, or interstate commerce. You look at what those words mean at the time. Or for the 14th Amendment, due process, that was enacted in 1868. So you look at what that kind of term might mean at the time. But that's, you know, original public meaning originalism is what that's called. And there are debates among originalists about how to use the various tools. It's been a very long time since the idea has been original intent, that is, to get into the head of James Madison or Thomas Jefferson and see what they thought about violent video games or the like. But really, there's not that much difference between originalism and textualism. It's just old constitutional provision versus relatively newer statutory ones.
So this goes along with another question. How were the framers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution expected to foresee and interpret events they couldn't have anticipated, such as violent video games? Did they expect Congress to evolve and to act on those things?
Well, there's certain times that amendments are necessary to take into account new developments. Other times they're not. So, for example, the power to regulate interstate commerce, again, enacted in 1789. I don't think we need a constitutional amendment to thereby give power to Congress to regulate steam ships or trains, let alone cars or airplanes, which obviously were not contemplated because they travel interstate, they deliver goods interstate, that sort of thing. Privacy concerns, the Fourth Amendment protection of persons, homes, effects, that sort of thing. Whether you're using infrared scanners or dogs or just a cop peering in the window or rifling through your stuff, we can understand what houses, people, and effects can mean. For newer things, let's say environmental regulation, right? Water can be polluted across watersheds. The air can be, you know, affected, or greenhouse gases, or climate change, or all of these things. But that's not commerce. Even though it's interstate, it's not commerce. So to be faithful to the Constitution, we would need a constitutional amendment to give federal power to regulate environmental stuff that goes across a state line. So you have to look at what exactly you're talking about. You know, computers or blogging, say, or, you know, writing newspaper articles on computer rather than with a printing press. It doesn't seem like you need to amend the First Amendment to contemplate these sorts of things. So it, the Constitution is fairly flexible, but certain times, either because we have new ideas about how government should be structured, like after the Civil War, to be able to sue a state if it's violating your individual rights, which you weren't able to do, or to end slavery, or to protect the right to vote for women, or what have you, amendments are needed. For other things, they're not.
So goes along with the next question. How realistic is passing a constitutional amendment to codify the court at 9 justices?
Have you seen how conflicted Congress is at this point? To get 2/3 of Congress and 3/5 of the states, 3/4 of the states, to agree on a constitutional amendment, pretty unlikely. The size of the Supreme Court, the questioner is right, is not in the Constitution. And we started with 6, we went up to 10, ended at 9. We've been at 9 since 1869. Each time the court's composition has changed, there were political reasons behind it. It's not simply the country grew, we added federal appellate circuits, and so we needed another justice. There were political reasons behind it, including shrinking it from 10 to 9 to deprive Andrew Johnson of the ability to appoint justices. So clearly changing the court size is now seen, as it always has been, as politicized. But it would take a constitutional amendment, and I don't know if that's a pretty high bar.
Okay, here's an off to the side question. Can you give an overview of the difference between anti-BDS laws in this country and freedom of speech? BDS people tend to say, well, whatever we do and say about Israel, that's freedom of speech, is it?
Yes. If for private individuals or companies to have whatever policy they want with regard to Israel or any other country, or, you know, whatever they want to enforce, whatever values they want to enforce, that's perfectly fine. The trouble is once it comes to the government, because the government is supposed to be neutral on expressions of values or opinion. Boycotting for a state government or a city government to boycott Israel or do certain other things, violates, you know, can even violate on federal foreign policy powers, for that matter. There was a case, a 40-year-old case involving, I think, Massachusetts boycotting Burma, and that was that policy was invalidated by the Supreme Court. So it depends on what kind of actor is acting and what exactly is being done. That's a general overview of the issue.
But your right to oppose doing business with Israel is your right to free speech.
As a private actor, it's whether it's speech or whether it's your right to your economic liberties or what have you. It's not a nationality based. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, there are protections, even, private businesses based on the Civil Rights Act of 1964, can't decline to do business with people of a certain race or sex or et cetera. Religion. So if a business, actually not religion, religion is a different category, but anyway, outside of those kind of discriminatory claims, but if your claim is based on, you know, boycotting a country, I think it would come more under the free speech.
Question. In your view, why has Justice Roberts or anyone else told the public who leaked the Roe versus Wade draft opinion before it was announced.
Presumably he doesn't know. I mean, I would hope that if the marshal of the court, if the justices have found out from their investigation who it was, one would hope that they would make that public. Because keeping it private does not solve the reason for which the investigation was called, because this leak, this unprecedented leak, really has inhibited the court's operation, the trust among the justices and the chambers, you know, the institutional, operations going forward. So presumably the leaker hasn't yet been discovered. That tells me that the investigation isn't as strong as it really should be. I mean, if there's not that many potential people involved, the justices, the clerks, a limited number of staff, you go through their emails, text messages, phone records, and that's it. I'm sure that could be found. That's not that large number of people. So I don't know if all the justices are cooperating or if the clerks are. The marshal probably doesn't have subpoena power. And John Roberts probably did not march every single clerk into his chambers and say, sign this piece of paper saying you are not the leaker on penalty of perjury. That's another way of doing it. I would have thought that whoever did it would have revealed him or herself once the term was over in the pages of the New York Times and, you know, reap the hero's reward from the left. But I guess that hasn't happened. You know, I do hope that we find out who it is, and that person, whatever their motivation, whoever it is socially and professionally punished. I'm not sure whether criminal laws were necessarily violated.
Okay. That's a very good point. I say that again, because I think there are people who believe that leaking was a criminal act. And
it depends on exactly what happened. If there was a computer hack, that might violate a federal law. If there was a taking of property that's not yours, that belongs to the federal government, you know, it's not an open and shut case, but it would be, it would depend on the facts, and it would be a tough criminal prosecution to maintain.
That's important to keep in mind, I think. Which leads to the next question, which is, following the release of that draft opinion, we began to see demonstrations at the homes of Supreme Court justices, and one of which involved someone who was arrested with a gun. Why has the administration been so slow to provide the kind of protection for them that, or to arrest the protesters, since it's against the law to do that? Nothing seems to happen. You know, people protest, and except for the guy who was arrested with a gun, no one seems to have paid a price for this.
Both the federal government and the county executives in the various Virginia counties and Montgomery County, Maryland, have been weak on this. The Montgomery County executive, not Ehrlich, that's the former governor, but a name like
Elrich.
That.
Elrich.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He said that they're all peaceful protests, you know, just like the mostly peaceful protests 2 years ago, I guess. I think, you know, more should be done to the extent that there are violations. You can parade down the street, assuming you're observing the various, you know, permitting requirements and not interfering with traffic and stuff like that. But you can't congregate in front of someone's home and, you know, keep them up in the middle of the night. You know, the political speech is at the core of the First Amendment, but that doesn't mean that I can go to your neighborhood at 2 a.m. and tell you exactly what I think through a bullhorn of what I think of President Biden or Trump or anybody else. I think the Justice Department could be doing more. Now, I think the justices do have around the clock protection. And at a certain point, one or more of them may have been taken to an undisclosed location. It's a hairy situation.
And the first response to this should be from the local levels. I mean, the county and the state people, because the question came in as, why is the administration not? But would you say
no? There are federal laws against intimidating judges, which I think can be applied. Unclear how that applies when it's after any decision. You know, they're not looking to influence a particular case at this point. But the state laws in both Maryland and Virginia are more directly on point.
Someone wants to ask you about Georgetown. how much of what happened to you?
Before we get into that, let me just clarify. I just see one other question to clarify what I said on BDS. Yeah, it's that which says that every Jewish organization interprets BDS as not being free speech, but inhibiting commercial relationships. It does that. I mean, it's very complicated. It depends on whether you're actually interfering with contract. If you're a private business that, if you're Ben and Jerry's and you don't want to, contract with the Israeli manufacturer of ice cream, you're welcome to do that. And then, of course, as we saw, Unilever, Ben and Jerry's parent company, countermanded that decision. If you're just protesting, that's free speech rights. But then it depends on what you're, if a state government is doing something, then that's not free speech. At that point, it becomes a different kind of analysis. But it's not. It depends what the specifics of any kind of BDS call and action is about. Go ahead about Georgetown.
About Georgetown. So if you could summarize it quickly, but the question is, how much of the animosity from Georgetown comes from political differences, and how much do you think might come from anti-Semitism, which is sort of a leftist, the questioner says, is a pillar of the current leftist establishment?
I didn't feel any anti-Semitism specifically. I mean, I don't read the comment section or some of the, Twitter trolls and stuff like that. The guy who instigated the whole Twitter mob against me when the news of my controversial tweet broke in late January is nominally Jewish himself, a Slate writer by the name of Mark Joseph Stern, who's just one of the worst people in the world. So I didn't really see much of that.
So you attribute their Georgetown's behavior to political differences with your opinion?
Absolutely. Intolerance, double standards, devaluing the freedom of speech, all of that.
And it really did look like you stayed at the Georgetown job until they told you could actually have it and then chose to leave. Is that how that worked out?
That's the way it, the basic facts of it. Yeah. When they reinstated me on a technicality, it took them 4 months to investigate and figure out that I wasn't an employee when I tweeted. And so the harassment and discrimination policies didn't apply to me. Clearly it was a cynical ploy to get the students off campus after the end of the semester. But then once I got the actual report from the diversity office, it became clear that my staying was untenable because the standard they were setting out implicitly replied their otherwise very, very strong speech and expression policy. It basically introduced a heckler's veto. Anytime someone claimed offense for something that I said or wrote, that would create a hostile educational environment subjecting me to discipline. And not only did they have that subjective standard, but they applied it unevenly because I gave examples in my resignation letter and my Wall Street Journal op-ed of left-wing professors who said and tweeted seemingly much more outrageous and inflammatory things than I did, and were not investigated or punished, nor should they have been, but it's free speech for thee and not for me.
This seems to be across college campuses, doesn't it? Hecklers, the concept of a heckler's veto, it's one thing it seems to me to protest, but another to shout down the speaker and make it impossible for the speaker to speak. I mean, that's fairly widespread at this point, I think.
That's exactly right. I'm perfectly, I travel and debate and do a lot of public speaking events. I'm perfectly open to hostile questions or, protests, holding up signs or whatever. The time my event was shut down and I was shouted down at UC Hastings Law School March 1st was actually the very first time I've ever been protested in more than 1,000 public events, more than 700 Federalist Society events. So either I'd been doing something right or something wrong, but this is an illiberal trend. This is not a liberal trend. It's not the decades old complaint about the liberal takeover of academia. That is nothing new. But what has changed, it's not kind of the ratio of liberals to moderates to conservatives, either among faculty or students, but the placating of radical illiberals by administrators and the therefore shifting and narrowing of the Overton window, the permissible range of policy views and expressions. That's what's changed. And I think this is probably what my next book is going to be about. It's especially a problem at law schools, right? These are not 18, 19, 20 year olds who are, you know, doing their thing. These are people who are supposed to be enforcing the rule of law, training to be advocates for positions and going to have positions of authority, and going to be facing things in their career that are much more uncomfortable or challenging than an offensive tweet or a speaker they don't agree with. And yet we've seen just in March of this year, my thing at Hastings, a Yale event was shut down. There was a similar kerfuffle at Michigan that didn't make the national media because the deans shut it down and nobody was live, you know, tweeting out a live video of it. But that's a very disturbing trend. And I'm pessimistic that things are going to improve in academia or in law schools. But the solution in academia is much simpler than it is in society more at large, because it's just a matter of, and we've seen this when deans, administrators, presidents just say, you know, we're not in the business of policing speech or wrongthink or what have you, and these things fizzle away. But there's a dearth of strength and spine among that class.
It disturbs me. I have a son who is a college professor, and what happens on campuses is very disturbing. We are coming to the end of the program, and I have to cover two really important things. The first is, what were you doing on the Colbert Report? And then I'll get to the other one.
So this was probably the pinnacle of my career 12 years ago now, after McDonald versus Chicago came down, extending the right to keep and bear arms to the states. And so I was on there to ostensibly debate the new civil rights of his handgun, whom he named Sweetness, against somebody from New Yorkers Against Gun Violence. And it was great fun. The other person I was, you know, effectively debating was not good, not in the sense of ideologically, but just was not good on TV. And so it ended up being kind of me and Steven going back and forth about different things. And the producer gave me some very good advice, said, you know, don't, you know, we've seen your stuff. We brought you on because, you know, you're effective at what you do, and don't try to be unfunny, but don't try to be extra funny. Just be yourself and treat this like you would Fox or CNN, again, like you normally do interviews, except the host is crazy. So just do your normal thing and Steven will do his thing and it'll work. And that's what happened.
And it worked, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Last question from a listener. Who is the hockey player in the picture behind you?
So I don't know how far you see it. So this is Alex Ovechkin, the captain of the Capitals. It's a signed picture. You know, he'll be a Hall of Famer. He's won many awards. And then below him, I don't know if you can see this. Here, I'll turn my camera.
Now we can.
Now you can. That's a caricature of me when I was 8 years old, dressed up as Wayne Gretzky. So there you go.
Okay. It's on that note that we're going to stop, because people who listen to this program know that I like to end on a happy note, and you have provided a happy note. I have to say that your conversation, as enlightening as it was, I really learned a lot, wasn't very happy. It's not very optimistic as a theory for how we're going to do business in the future, and what the politics of the court will look like, and what the politics of the country will look like because of the court. So I'm happy that we at least got your caricature in there. And allow me to say to the audience, please, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. This is a book, if you think I'm right and you think that we've got a problem here, this is a book you need to read. This is Ilya's book. It came out in hardcover 2 years ago. It came out in paperback this month. Please buy it. Please read it.
It's also available in Audible and Kindle and even CDs if you want it. The paperback has an epilogue updating us for the last 2 years. And in addition, I started a Substack. That's like a digital newsletter, which you can read online or get delivered to your email inbox. There's a paid version, a free version. It's called Shapiro's Gavel. And there I write things that you wouldn't see from me necessarily in the Wall Street Journal or Newsweek or National Review. But my last one was actually an autobiographical essay about how I got to thinking the things and where I am in my life. So I'll commend that to you as well.
Hold up the book.
Sure. This is the paperback, complete with a designation as one of Wall Street Journal's books of 2021. And this is the hardcover, which, since the paperback came out, is available pretty cheap on Amazon.
There you go. Everybody, thank you for joining us. Ilya Shapiro, thank you for an enlightening, if not particularly happy afternoon, but we really do appreciate it. We need you. We need you to talk about the things as they really happen. So thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you.